Fans, we are back live with another edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jack Kilby, Executive Vice President of Great North Wrestling, and I'm really, really pleased tonight to have with me a man who is an ECW original, an ECW referee, who's had quite a career in the business. He's been there for so many and been instrumental in so many great classic moments. I'm talking about Jim Molyneux. Jim, thanks for coming today.
Thanks for having me on. Should be fun.
Absolutely. I like to start with career respective interviews, looking at your background as a fan. Were you a fan growing up in the business? And if so, I guess being in the Northeast, what companies did you follow, sir?
Yeah, well, I was a fan of the business, and unfortunately, it was only company to follow because I was a kid before something called cable television. So we only got the WWF. So we had the Vince Sr. product. So I grew up on Bruno Sammartino and Bob Backlund and the Samoans and Tito Santana, personal favorite, Dean Ho. That's what I grew up on. And I got away from it for a while and started watching again when Hulkamania got going. And in the meantime, found the NWA on cable television. So I was like, wow, this is impressive compared, I liked the grittiness of the NWA compared to the circusness of the WWF at the time. Mm-hmm. And it just started, getting into it. And a guy that I worked with, I mean, at this time I'm 26 years old. So a guy I worked with was into it too. And we, would talk about it at work all day. And it finally I never went to a match as a kid. Finally went to a match with the first show I went to was the Great American Bash 1987 in Philadelphia. That was a hell of an impressive show to see.
No kidding.
To hook me into the business. And I just got hooked and, grew from there.
What was there a moment where you decided, I want to become involved in the business, or how did that work? And how did you land on the referee role?
Well, I wanted to be a manager. And I went to a no-name place to train to be a manager. I had an idea. The inspiration was Bobby Heenan on WWF and Jim Cornette on the NWA. Both kind of wise guys, sharp tongue. I kind of had that reputation in high school, the wise ass. So I thought, I can do that. So I did it for a little bit. And at the time, Joel Goodhart had the Tri-State Wrestling Alliance. And I knew Joel through the fan club that he had, and I had joined. And so I called him, and I said, hey, could you use me as a manager in TWA? And he said, no. I said, I already have three or four managers, and but I could use a referee. And gave me the sell on being a referee, going to the school that he had, he said, gave me the whole cell and said, call me back in a couple of days and let me know what you think. So I hung up and I called him back 10 minutes later and said, I'm in. And the following Tuesday, I was at the school training to be a referee.
Now, in terms of the referee's role, we'll get into some of the intricacies thereof later, but when you were looking at referees in terms of like a template for you or a role model or an inspiration to follow, did you have one of those? I know a lot of people look at the Hebners, Tommy Young, et cetera, but was there an individual that you looked at that you admired his work once you had already agreed to take on the position?
It was definitely the Hebners and Tommy Young. Tommy Young more than the Hebners, because he got a little involved more mm-hmm. than they did. You saw the back and forth he would have with Ric Flair in one of his matches. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I can get away with doing something every once in a while as a referee, and not to steal anything from the guys, because I know that's not my position in as a referee. So yeah, Tommy Young was the one I really watched. And then when I started looking at deeper into them, one of the WWF guys who was a local guy, out of New York, Billy Caputa. And, you know, I watched him because I felt that he gave the impression of this is real. And I think that's important for a referee. For me, that's the main thing as a referee. If I make it look like I'm reacting to what is real, then hopefully the fans will catch that, kind of like a transmitter between the wrestlers and the fans. And so I they're really the four that you think of, that I think of the most.
Mm-hmm. Morris Shorthall, the man who is Mr. Cheap Heat himself, who isn't on the podcast tonight, but nonetheless says, thanks for coming on, Jim, especially with the ECW vibe coming back to Philly next month.
Yeah, there's a big vibe about the ECW presence in Philadelphia for WrestleMania weekend. And, you know, it's something different. You don't see that. If they were to have it in Charlotte, I don't know you'd be getting the NWA and, you know, reaction, or if it was in New Orleans, you wouldn't have, you know, a bunch of people doing a Mid-South, mm-hmm. you know, convention or whatever. The ECW is a very, very intricate and interesting phenomenon in the business.
Which is, you know what, I had something to ask about TWA, but I think I'll jump up to my other question, which is, Can you talk about that Philly style of wrestling that of course seemed to be birthed with TWA over to Eastern Championship and then ECW? Because I don't think some of the younger fans realize that Philly was basically a market that the WWF and NWA went to. They had those shows at the Spectrum, but it wasn't unique from any major metropolitan center during that time frame. But then with the birth of TWA, ECW, etc., it took on that unique vibe and feeling, of which I was fortunate enough in the 90s to experience on the corner of Swanson and Rittner myself. Is there a way that you can sum up that Philly style that makes sense?
Well, I think you have to look at the fans also. I really think the fans are the ones who push for that style. It's a very working class area. They highly demand 110% all the time from their sports teams. If you look at, you know, the Eagles and the Phillies and the Flyers and the Sixers, that's what it is. The Flyers were successful in Philadelphia because those were hard-nosed, hard-working guys. And when they won the Stanley Cup, I was luckily around that at the time. And you know, we really appreciated it. And those guys appreciated the fans so much so that a lot of them never left the area. They still live here. So I really give that Philly style of wrestling credit to the fans. If TWA was doing things like the WWF at the time, and, you know, the Hulk Hogan style and all the, you know, the glitz and glamour and all that, I don't think it would have gone anywhere. I think what Joel brought in was what the fans wanted to see. They wanted to see a Memphis style of wrestling where, you know, hardworking, you know, beat the crap out of each other. Someone gets their hand raised, you know, at the end of the match. You know, and that reflected on who he brought in. Guys from Japan who all Japan who worked like that. Guys from, like I said, Memphis and Mid-South and guys who were between the NWA and going to WWE or the other way around. They're all hardworking guys. You know, I don't think Joel would, would have brought in like a Doink or you know, something that was a character. It was something that had to be real to the people.
Wouldn't have turned Chris Candido into a Body Donna, for example.
Right. Never happened.
Yeah. Again, I'm gonna jump forward a little bit, but
okay. And I'm gonna play with my lighting here. I'm sorry.
No worries, man.
There you go.
Perfect.
That's even worse. You know what it is? I'm not used to doing these during the day, so I'm gonna turn my night lights on. There we go. That's better. Now you can see my ugly face better.
Looks perfect. In terms of that that ECW arena in South Philly, and just. It's become, a mythology now almost, but for those that were there, you understand, what was it about, let's be honest, a subpar facility with leaking toilets and...
if it had toilets.
If it did, yes. 150 degrees in there. What was it about that setting that created the magic that was Eastern Championship Wrestling in ECW?
I think it was just the gathering of everyone. You know, again, the fans wanted to see hard-hitting matches, and we knew that we had to give it to them. And the more we gave it to them, the more fans came out. You know, once they saw the TV and saw what we were doing, a lot of people were like, wow, that's not what I'm used to. And I have to go see that, or I have to be a part of it. I always compare us, the ECW, to like the band Nirvana. Yeah, they came along real quick. We're hot, and you know they ended real fast. I really think that we're a punk rock band. That punk rock era. We came and conquered and took no prisoners. And when it was time to go, we left. Mm-hmm. Not that some of us wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By way of TWA's laid the foundation, it created the realism that you're talking about, that hard-hitting style in Philly. Then the transition happened to Eastern. Was that, how did that come about for you, and specifically dealing with Todd Gordon, who was, I guess, a sponsor, or he was there in the shows, but not running the show per se.
Right. Yeah. He helped out financially more than anything with TWA, and had finally said, I put enough into it. And so Joel had to shut down. And it's a shame that last show would have been really interesting to see that he had set up, made the,
with,
you know,
with Buddy Rogers against Landell.
Yeah. And the tag match, I always say I would have hit the locked John Finnegan in a broom closet to do the tag match that was scheduled, which was Williams and Gordy against Furnace and LaFon.
Yeah.
And you know, that never happened in the US. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the only time it did. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Goodhart was making the announcement on a Saturday morning that, you know, couldn't go on anymore, and this is it. We're ending the company. We're ending the radio show, the whole bit. And so I got a call. Actually, I called John, and he said, I think something's happening. I called John Finnegan. We've been friends forever, since TWA. And he said, I think something's brewing. Hang on. You know, and he called me back, and he said, yes, Todd and Larry Winters, who was the original booker for ECW, and Bob Ortiz, they were working on something. Bob was our ring announcer. So maybe a couple weeks after, you know, went by, and I finally was told, yeah, we're going to start something. Give us time to, you know, get all the paperwork done and set up with the state and all that kind of stuff, and we'll let you know. You're definitely in if you want. And I said, yes, I want. And that was really how it started. I can't remember the first show. I'm sure it was at the Philly Sports Bar, which was a great location. It was a Philadelphia sports bar owned by several of the the sports legends in Philadelphia. And it was right in Center City. And it was perfect for me because I was working across the river at the RC, the old RCA company. And I could catch the speed line from New Jersey. So I could take the speed line from my house, go to work, have my wrestling or my referee gear with me, work all day, and then take the train on into Philly because the train stop was right underneath the sports bar, and go do the matches and then just go home from on the subway. But yeah, that was how it started for me. And I was there from day one. John Finnegan and I are the only two guys that were there the entire run of the company.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the Paul Heyman era and some questions around that, we've heard mixed reviews about the tenure of Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert as the booker and his vision with Todd, and then the whole switch that happened there. How did you find Eddie Gilbert, who's got to get a lot of credit for bringing again that Memphis style
right
to Philly? How did you find working with him personally?
I never had a problem with him. He was very professional, and I had worked with him previously in TWA. Joel loved Eddie Gilbert and would bring him in for the shows. And that's where those series of Cactus Jack and Eddie Gilbert matches happened. That, you know, was a big tape trading thing at the time. But yeah, I'd worked with him before. Very professional. Would come in with a big long sheet of paper and hang it up on the door with 3 or 4 weeks worth of TV to be taped. And that was it. But, you know, I'm sure he would ask for your, you know, input. At the time, I was still super green. So I didn't get involved with, you know, in any kind of input. It wasn't until after, was it the Paul era? Yeah, Paul era. And Kevin Sullivan was still with us at the time. And he was going over a match with his opponent. And he stopped and he said, and he turned to me and he said, in his Boston accent that I can't do, Jimmy, does that make you look bad as a referee? And I was like, what? Excuse me? You're asking my opinion? I was like, oh my God, Kevin Sullivan's asking me what I think about the match. That was when I really felt like, wow, I'm in now. But yeah, Eddie was fine to work with. I never had a problem with him.
So then there was a, it's been characterized as a fallout between Todd and Eddie Gilbert. And then Paulie appeared on the scene. How was that situation framed to you as an employee at the time?
Paul came in, he said, I'm the booker now. But Paul had been there. Paul was there working with Eddie. He was his manager. He was managing Jimmy Snuka. He had a couple of people that he managed. So Paul was already there. So for him to come in and take over the booker, I don't think was a big shock, as opposed to if someone else were to come in that didn't work for the company. And it was a fairly smooth transition. It was a different style of booking where, like I said, Eddie, you know, had weeks and weeks of TV ready, knew what he wanted to do, where it started to get to the point where Paul knew what he wanted for the major stories. But otherwise, he'd sit down, open up his book, look around, start writing names down and coming up with matches for everybody else. And, you know, but like I said, you get the main stories across that he wanted to.
As you're aware, no doubt, the talk of the Hall of Fame this year is Paul Heyman's induction into same. And notwithstanding, you know, I don't think anybody's going to ever argue that the man had an uncanny mind for the business and a genius level for the way pro wrestling was, and not only that, but innovation back in the day. But he's also a polarizing figure in terms of ways that I'm sure everybody watching this podcast is aware. But What
really?
What is, well, yes, and maybe we'll ask about that in terms of your pay issues or not. But what is your thought on that coming together right now that he's getting that honor for his work? I guess it's his body of work, but his work in WWE as well, which really in the last 5 years, you can't argue with. He's almost hitting his,
right.
his stride.
Yeah. I mean, he as a person in the business, as a figure in the business, absolutely deserves a great mind for it. Business wise, not so much. Mm. The reason that I wear headphones when I do podcasts, this is so that my wife doesn't hear his name mentioned. And I always say, it's if you ever saw Young Frankenstein, when they say Frau Blücher, and the horse is whinny in the background from every portion of the castle, if that name is mentioned, her head will come poking through the door. but no, he deserves it for what he's done with it, even with just doing what he's done with the WWE. If it was just the WWE stuff, I don't think it would be happening. I think they're tying in the ECW thing, and doing that. I would love to have, and I think this is the only, ECW is the only company you do this with, but I would love to have seen ECW as an entity, as a company, be put in.
Yes.
I don't think you can do it with any other, and have a handful of the guys up there, let Paul do the talking. That's fine. And have guys up there who aren't always recognized, for what they did for the company.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that, they should really consider, along with recognizing, the role that, people like yourself in the Eastern Championship Wrestling TWA guys played in what ECW Extreme Championship Wrestling became.
Let me jump in real quick. The person that I think deserves to be in the Hall of Fame was in TWA and was in ECW is Bam Bam Bigelow. And this would be a great place to do it. I don't know why. There's got to be some kind of stupid political reason. But with a new regime in there, you might see a lot of those guys that should be in there get in there finally. And top of my list is Bam Bam Bigelow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You cannot argue with a Hall of Fame career. Fan is asking, how much does Paul owe you in back pay?
I'm not going to tell you exactly. By the way, Paul doesn't owe me the money. HHG does. HHG LLC, of course, that's what he would tell you. But I'm not going to say, but it's a large figure.
Mm-hmm. Like so many others. Morris is asking if you were surprised that RVD and Sabu were busted for smoking weed in WWE.
No.
clearly that's not one. What I touched on earlier in terms of all the great moments that you were instrumental in putting matches together in ECW. What would you, if you had to boil it down to a couple, what would you say were your most memorable moments in the company there?
I think the two that come to mind first, and they're not exactly my favorite matches. People always ask about favorite match, and it's a different subject. But I think the two matches, because they were so important to the company and helped us get on various maps. The first one that comes to mind is the three-way dance between Shane Douglas, Sabu, and Terry Funk. 60-minute draw, no winner. That got us on a very important map at the time, which was the tape trading business. Everybody heard about it and wanted to see it, but couldn't because we didn't have syndication or anything like that. So here come the tape traders. And that got us on that map. And that was the first big step for us for fans outside of the Philadelphia area. That's how we got to 1,200 people in the arena that's only supposed to hold 880.
Yep, myself included.
And then after that, the next match for me would be Taz and Sabu for Barely Legal. That was the match, whether it was the match of the night or it wasn't even the main event. but it was the match that got the company there. 2 years of not touching each other, two years of promos, 2 years of you know, teasing the crowd, and finally it happens. And when the bell rings, you listen to that crowd. They tell the story. Again, back to the fans. They're telling the story just as much as the wrestlers are. They've been waiting for it. Now they got it.
Can you imagine something like that in present day when AEW burns through 6 to 9 months of storyline in 3 weeks?
Yeah, that's crazy. It's crazy. It's not even really a subject I want to get to, but we'll go that way if you want.
Well, yeah, I think it speaks for itself. On the flip side, Morris is interested to know what your, and I have a couple of questions sort of related to this down in a bit, but what was your most difficult moment as a ref in ECW?
Probably the time I got hurt. The Heat Wave 2000, the main event between Tommy Dreamer and Justin Credible. And this is stupid how I got hurt, but I'm climbing over the guardrail, following them through the crowd. And cameraman comes up from behind me, and I guess he didn't see me. He didn't see me in his lens and knocked me off the guardrail. And you would think, okay, you know, it's the guardrail. I only have to drop, you know, 6 inches from my heels to the concrete floor. But I went knee first and did a partial ACL tear and drugged my leg through the rest of the match. If you watch it, you go back and watch it, and I think it's on Peacock. I count 1, 2, 3, and I roll to the edge of the ring, tell the security guys to get me out of there. I couldn't put any more weight on it at all. I don't know how I did it. And I thought of it the other week because I just got over rupturing my meniscus. Again, I couldn't put any weight on my leg. And it's one of those things that has to heal itself. And knock wood, it did, and back up on my feet, and I'll be back in the ring at the end of the or in the beginning of April.
Good stuff. In terms of ECW, it seems to be synonymous not only with a chaotic atmosphere backstage, et cetera, but also in the ring itself. And I wanted to ask you, there are instances, at least spoken of. In the mythology of cases where wrestlers have been in a condition other than normal in the ring, and some names jump out there. How in the world did you, given the central role that a ref has in a match, how did you perform your duties with those sort of crazy parameters?
I don't know how we did it. We just happened to make it work. We still, if you watch the matches, we're still, if they're outside, we're counting 10. Come on back in the ring, you know. And we're trying to get the rules laid out. And somehow it worked. I don't know how. You know, we allowed the trash cans. We allowed the chairs, things like that. No reason as to why. There was no, you know, commissioner to come out and say, chairs are legal. Tables are only allowed if they're 8 feet long, no 6 foot table, you know, something ridiculous like that. But yeah, we just seem to make it work and make it seem real. Like, and I think the fans appreciate it because I think they realize that maybe in a way we're giving them what they wanted without, you know, being the vice principal.
Without the well, that's what as a young man, that's what attracted me to ECW was the realism, because you know a lot of fans of a certain era grew up with that cartoon atmosphere, and it's fine to be you know Hulkamaniac or whatever,
right.
In the 80s as a kid, but then ECW just hit at the right time and the right moment for a certain generation of fans.
Yeah, I think that. Our reaction to things that happen in the ring kind of helped a long way. Like if I did a barbed wire match and they're grinding their head into the barbed wire and I'd be checking and looking at, oh, I'm going to be sick. It's too much blood. You know, I think that kind of helped along. But you know, with covering up the fact that we weren't, you know, throwing everybody out or disqualifying every match.
Mm-hmm. That's a, you raise an interesting point there that I've had a bone of contention with, without singling out any referees that currently work for ECW. I asked this question of Earl Hebner when I had the opportunity to, sorry, not AEW. When I interviewed him, was how do you strike that balance between being acting in a manner that a ref should and showing true emotion, like you just touched on, and then not making it like yourself the center of attention, taking away from the action in the ring. And again, not to mention any particular referees that currently work for AEW, but you know the one I'm speaking of. That is something that a lot of fans have picked up on because it's so egregious. But in ECW, you guys managed to pull that off.
Yeah, like I said, it's just I think that John and I and the other guys who were in and out through the company let our real reactions come through, or what seemed to be our real reactions. A lot of them really were our real reactions. Some of the stuff was, like you said, crazy. And I think our natural reaction, it was important to that. It would be a different story if we were like a WWE or a WCW, where they didn't do a lot of the extreme stuff. I think we would have reacted differently. And not just that referee on AEW you're speaking of. I think the problem with modern day referees is that they're not allowed to be involved to the point of, you know, helping the match along. Seems like sometimes they just stand in the corner and wait until it's time to count to three. Mm-hmm. And I think if they got mentioned on the broadcast by their name a little more often, if they were, you know, people knew who they were. I don't know who some of the referees are sometimes. You know, I think that they would be involved a little bit more. And I think they need to be. They, you know, there needs to be some sort of authority there. I mean, it's there, but nobody pays attention to it because it's not put out there.
Which kind of dovetails into the next question that I had about ECW pushing the boundaries of traditional wrestling. And as you mentioned already, you had to just keep going through certain situations and provide regular or your actual emotion to things that were occurring. One of the criticisms that I don't share, but has traditionally been levied against ECW and the officiadom, is that the referees are constantly being buried by what's happening in terms of not, you know, adhering to the authority, the counts, et cetera, et cetera. How do you respond to that in the context of, you know, what you were trying to accomplish there?
Yeah, I don't think that's true, because I can remember, you know, matches where, you know, they're backed up against the rope. All right, break off the rope. 1, 2, row, broke. Then go back to choking or in the corner or whatever. You know, the basic rules that apply to a wrestling match, I think we enforced them. When it got to, you know, going through the tables and all that kind of stuff, it was a reactionary thing for us. That's where our reaction comes in, as opposed to worrying about the rules. I mean, you know, they'd go through the table that's on fire. Well, I think my reaction, not as a referee, doesn't matter anymore. My reaction as a human being is, give me some water so I can help put this guy out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, people look at it that way. I know I always did something like that, or tried to get some help or tried to put them out if it needed to be, or I count 1, 2, 3 real quick, even though you're not supposed to, and then douse them with water or help them. You know, it becomes more of a human thing in that extreme situation.
Absolutely. ECW, you know, created a number of really controversial moments, be it Funk with the branding iron that, you know, some fire went into the crowd, Tommy Dreamer pile driving a woman, all of New Jack's Falls, et cetera, et cetera. What stands out in your mind in terms of matches that you were involved with or moments that you were involved with that was particularly controversial in the original ECW?
Not that it was, I didn't do the match, but I had to help carrying them out. I would say the crucifixion angle with the Sandman. Poor reaction from the crowd, poor reaction from a lot of the guys in the locker room. I caught a bunch of heat because I went out and got him and helped carry him back. They're like, you know, you have to go out there and get him. I'm like, and people gave me crap about it. Fans did. And I'm like, well, what are you going to do? Leave him there? You're going to wrestle around him the rest of the night? You had to get him out of there. So we got him out of there. So yeah, that one was kind of that stung and stung for a long time. I think we lost some fans there. We had to win some guys back. And it didn't offend me as much as others. I wasn't offended as much as I knew, that's not right. But you know, I really think we did lose a handful of fans there.
Were there any angles or moments such as that you heard about in the back before the show that you were like, oh my goodness, you know, what are they thinking type of deal? Did you hear about the crucifixion ahead of time?
No, I didn't. I had no idea. I don't know how many people did. I'd have to go back and look at the match. I don't even remember who reffed it, whether it was John or someone else. But yeah, no, I never got any word about anything where I'm like, whoops, that's not going to go over well.
As you had a greater tenure in the company, were you involved in any of the decisions in terms of creatively or business wise of where to run and some of the other fine points of say house shows or non televised events?
Not creatively. I did help the promotions of the company. At one point we ran a couple of local things here in South Jersey, and I would help get flyers out and posters and all that kind of stuff. Cause I was here. But then the offer came along about a year and a half before the company ended, to come on the promotions team. So again, with the flyers and all that kind of putting a street team together for towns, and I would do the secondary towns, they would have a larger team for where we were maybe doing television. So let's say we're doing television Saturday night in Chicago. Well, Friday night we're at a smaller town. Peoria was what we did in Illinois. So I would fly to Illinois and meet up with street team and get that all put together. If I needed to touch base with radio station or television or something with tickets or whatever, I'd be there to handle it for a few days. Then I'd catch up to wherever we were for the shows that weekend for the live events, but not creatively now.
Towards the end of the tenure, and there were rumors that Paulie was looking to get another television deal after not the best deal with the Nashville network, et cetera, et cetera. Were you surprised when the last show happened and that was it? I've talked to a lot of ECW original folks, and some were like, no, we knew it was happening. Some were completely taken off guard.
I kind of knew it was happening. I thought maybe we could get one more pay-per-view. We had a pay-per-view scheduled. I don't know if we had put tickets on sale or whatnot, but I think it was in New York, supposed to be in New York. And I thought, well, if we are going to end, that would probably be the best place to end. But they pulled the plug before we even got there. So it was a little surprise, but I kind of felt it coming on.
How did you find out personally?
You know what? I don't even remember. It was such a shell-shocking moment that I just didn't believe it, because we kind of got, or at least some of us were, well, yeah, we can't, we're still going to do, we got, you know, Danbury scheduled, we have New York scheduled, and we're going to try to get those done. We're going to move on if we can. So it wasn't really like, you know, oh, we're dead in the water, sorry guys. It was, you know, they you tried to lead us on for more shows, and hopefully it'll come through. But you know, you can only hope and wait for so long until you see Paul on TV.
Yeah, I was also going to ask you about that when he was supposedly negotiating another deal, and then he was on Raw, which some of the ECW folks have said, yeah, it was a complete shock and surprise. Right.
But it could have been a working situation where, I mean, look at Jim Cornette. You know, he was on TV and was still doing some Smoky Mountain, you know, and they were starting to set up training territories. So there was the possibility that, hey, maybe ECW could be a territory for him, and we could be getting some guys to train to move on up. And hopefully, you know, they'll ask me to be part of that. But that never happened. I think it would have been a great, I think ECW should have kind of stayed a little territorial, would have helped the finances a little bit, I think, instead of flying everybody all over the country.
Did you have knowledge of the time, or was it super ultra kayfabe that WWE was financing ECW to an extent, weekly or monthly or whatever Mr. Heyman was receiving from Titan?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it. There was always the talk because, well, we have this guy or that guy, and they're also under contract with WWE. So there was some kind of working arrangement, just not exactly know what the deal details were. But if it'll keep us afloat, I don't care.
Well, exactly, yeah. A fan on social media wanted me to ask you about the atmosphere in the company with the famous Mike Awesome WCW, Taz comes back, takes the title off him, et cetera, et cetera. That very famous situation. What do you recall of that?
I'll tell you what, I don't know what the situation was like in the locker room, because I got pulled from the locker room and was the go-between Paul and Tommy and Taz and Mike Awesome and Doug Dillinger. Mike came in with Doug Dillinger, head of security for WCW. And so I had to go. They're like, okay, go see Paul. He's at so-and-so restaurant in Indianapolis that night. That as soon as I pulled in the parking lot, go see Paul. So I went, and it was like a scene from The Sopranos or Godfather or something, where Paul's sitting in the middle of the table. It's like, you know, one of those semicircle big tables at a Chinese restaurant, and all the boys are sitting around them. And so I was told, okay, here's the contract that for Mike. Tell him, da 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 da. Do not venture from any other words. Don't say this instead of that. Very, very particular. So I went. Here you go. They signed whatever. Took it back. I think this is the right sequence. Came back with Taz and Dreamer. And Dreamer and I sat there with Doug. Taz and Mike went off and talked, I guess, you know, specifics of the match and how it was going to be. Everything was settled. I went to the building, got dressed. The matches were already started. Got dressed. I did nothing until that match. I knew exactly what was going to happen and how it was going to go down, the whole thing. Mike through the front of the building and out through the building. Indianapolis cops escorting him. They did not want him in the locker room at all. Mm-hmm. I think maybe for his own safety, because there's some nutty people in our locker room. So, I mean, the match went down, whatever everybody's seen on TV, the match went down, and that was it. And like I said, it was a whirlwind, and I really, I don't know if I was lucky or not to be involved in it, but that's how it went down with for me. I wasn't in the locker room prior to just before that. I mean, I had enough time just to get dressed and get out there for the match.
Wow. Very, very memorable moment. Ibzan is asking your thoughts on, of course, we couldn't talk about the original ECW without Joey Styles and his innovative one-man booth commentary.
Joey was great at what he did. I give a lot of credit to Joey for people knowing the referees. He would make sure the referees were mentioned every show, in at least once in a match. And nobody was doing that. Nobody would do that. And I mean, for a while, you couldn't even, they mention them now every once in a while, but WWE never mentioned guys' names. WCW would, just because, you know, Pee Wee Anderson, God bless him, God rest his soul, and great referee, was a bit of a character. So he would be mentioned. Tommy Young would be mentioned, but only if he got into a conflict with Ric Flair or did something with Jim Cornette. I'm sure John would say this too. That we owe Joey a lot. We can, you know, nobody would know who we are.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to the WWE and the one night stand pay-per-views. Two-part question. Can you talk about your thoughts on that and that experience? And then whether or not the – and I'm always interested in the answer to this question. Are you of the belief that WWE resurrected ECW following the success of the first one-night stand in order to, for lack of a better term, kill the fan – the enduring fan love and support of the original?
Absolutely. I believe it. They didn't want, or I shouldn't say they, I would say Vince McMahon did not want something that he didn't create to be more popular than anything he created. And the myth, the, you know, whatever you want to call it, of ECW was outshined what was going on with the Attitude Era. If it wasn't for, you know, everyone would tell them, if it wasn't for ECW, there wouldn't be an Attitude Era. Well, I created the Attitude Era, so, you know, it can't be an ECW. So I think he did the first one, or they created the first one, just to test the water, and the reaction that they got, I think they were surprised by. I don't think they expected the rapid fandom, because they weren't getting that in, you know, their, for every match. There was, you know, people went crazy for whoever came out, and they weren't getting that on their events. The second one was a completely different animal. You know, they knew they were going to set up the program. We went into, or at least I did, went into the pay-per-view being told, we're gonna restart ECW. We want you to be part of it. Great. Did the pay-per-view, went to the TV taping two nights later in Trenton, New Jersey, stood around, refereed a battle royal. That was the only match that I was involved in. And I think they only had maybe two matches that night, and I think John probably did the other. Never offered a deal. So then it started change their attitude, or their reasoning started changing. Well, we want you for all the shows that you can get to. And remember, they were going to put us out on tour on our own. They had shows scheduled in Wisconsin and all over the place. We want you to get to the shows that you can get to. Well, I can't get to Wisconsin. Now I've got a 9-to-5 job. I own a courier service. So I'm not walking away from, I'm not shutting it down to restart this dream again. So like the next week was in Albany, New York. And it's a bit of a drive, but I did it. And still no deal offered. Then it became, then the next week was in West Virginia. And I was like, I'm not going to West Virginia. That's too much of a drive for me. I'd miss 2 days of work, but the whole bit. Then that's when it became, well, we'll let you know when we need you. Okay. Well, the next event was at the arena and TV at the big building, it's the Wells Fargo now. Never heard from them. And I've never been one to go to a show trying to look for work or beg for work or what about me or I'm over here, look at me. And I never called them to say, hey, do you need me? And I said, well, that's it. And never looked back and don't regret not doing it because it wasn't the same. And I don't blame the guys who replaced other wrestlers. Those guys put on great matches. It was just, you know, I always say this. It wasn't my mom's ECW anymore.
No. And it seemed like a lot of the original talent were used as cannon fodder when I couldn't understand why they were being used. And I'm talking about Steven Richards and
right.
That's incredible. And those guys, like they seem to be just getting squashed and it made no sense to me.
Right. The ring announcer, Steve DeAngelis, they used him for the pay-per-view. He showed up 2 days later at Trenton and they told him, we don't need you. Didn't even give him enough time to get dressed. They met him at the door. We don't need you.
Yeah,
so I knew right there everything was changed.
That was a head scratcher. I've also interviewed Steven a couple of times, and he had also indicated that they had made reference to offering him a contract, and then he was met at the door with that. So yeah, not the best business practice to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the contracts. One was offered this isn't my story to tell. I'll just tell it basically. John Finnegan was offered a deal and turned it down because they didn't offer healthcare and he needed it for his family. I didn't need it. So I would have been willing to take a contract, but never came. So, and I was fine with that. Next in line was Mike Keener. And you know, one of the final referees with ECW, they never offered him a deal either. So they had their plan all set and they just, you know, let us hang in the wind.
Did you, during this time frame that you were doing these events, did you run into Mr. McMahon or have any interactions with him?
The only time was the first pay-per-view. He had come in. We were having a meeting. I forget who was running it, but he came in and he said, go out there and give the ECW fans the show that they want. And I'll be signing the checks, not Paul. Ha ha ha. And left. But I got to stand behind him in Gorilla while the matches were going on because we wanted to, you know, referees always ready to go. So I just happened to be right behind him because there was no room to like stand next to him or the stage was very small. And that's where they had the gorilla set up.
In terms of reunion shows in general, I know they ran a couple under the Hardcore Homecoming and then Extreme Rising was a promotion that Shane Douglas was involved in. What are your, and then in Canada, we had Hardcore Road Trip in 2013. In 2014, which advertised itself as ECW in Canada and had some ECW originals there, most notably my partner, ECW original Kingpin Medina. But what are your thoughts on those tribute shows in general that seem to pop up every now and again?
I really couldn't give you an opinion on them because I wasn't invited and wasn't part of them. So I've never seen any of them, never seen a single match of any of them. Even the TNA pay-per-view that they did, I wasn't a part of. So I really can't give you an opinion on those.
Do you think it's disingenuous to continue to try to make money from the spirit of the original ECW, or?
I think it depends on how it's done. I think what's going on this for WrestleMania, I think there are different ECW angles throughout, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of independent shows that are cropping up, and all the guests that are going to be at the various conventions seem to be ECW heavy. So I think that so far they seem to be doing well with the way they're doing it. And we'll see what happens after the match.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of a lasting legacy or impact, and this is always a difficult question, but if you had to boil that down, what would you say, given the fact that you were there for the whole shebang, the lasting impact of the ECW phenomenon is on the business today?
Okay, clear out. I don't know. I as a referee, it's kind of different. We never looked for the spotlight. We never looked to be out there for everyone to praise or hey, you know, I'm a big fan of yours or whatever. I was just happy to be along for the ride. I had the best seat in the house. If I didn't have to count to three, I would have ordered, you know, a hot dog and a beer.
What are you up to lately, Jim? And where can the fans keep in touch with your activities and appearances, et cetera, work on social media, sir?
I've made a recent return to the ring. I took 15 years off. I was running a local independent promotion in school called OTW, Old Time Wrestling, and closed everything up kind of during the pandemic and got back into the ring. The people I sold the ring to offered me a position to do a couple of shows. I was like, okay, let me go back in the ring. And I got to work with John Finnegan again. So that was like, yeah, I'll do that. So I've been doing independence in the New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania area for the last couple of years now. I've done some seminars and signing, a lot of signings. I've got a lot of the things like that coming up. Where you can get me is, let's see, I'm always troubled with this right here. that's my X account or Twitter, whatever you want to call it. And there, if you want to book me for anything, it has my email on it. You can email me. April is completely booked up. Mm-hmm. Most of May is too. Got a lot of, there's a couple of conventions coming up in May and one in July, that are going to be a lot of fun. But yeah, I've been getting a lot of referee bookings, and I usually put up there on Twitter and also on Facebook. Facebook's the same thing, basically. My upcoming schedule or how you can get a hold of me. And I sell T-shirts. They're all mock T-shirts of ripoffs of some wrestling phrases, such as, you know, EC Ref and W. Instead of Austin 316, referee 123, acknowledge your referee. Refamania is running wild, which is available in red and yellow.
Is that a pro wrestling tea store? Or is that just
available? No, it's at Tee Public. So if you go to teepublic.com, go to their search, punch in extreme referee, at least one of the shirts will come up, and then you can go to the store from there. But when I do appearances, I've got a handful of the EC Ref and W shirts with me, and I've got pictures and trading cards and DVD and all kinds of stuff.
That's awesome. Well, we'll definitely keep in touch and see what you have on the go. Sounds very full. Last question before I let you go, though, sir, is there's a lot of talk. I recently interviewed Joel Goodhart. Tony Stetson. And last night we had the one and only Johnny Hotbody on the show. There's talk about a TWA reunion show, one last great show. If that comes to pass, would you be in, sir?
If they offer, I'm there. I would love to be there. All they have to do is ask and I'm there.
Well, we will definitely stay in touch on the basis of that, because Great North Wrestling is interested in working with Joel on that one. So we'll definitely keep in touch. But I want to thank you very much for your time this evening. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. It was fun. Peace, everyone.
Fans, that's it for this edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. Thank you very much for viewing, and we will see you live next on Friday with XPW, former XPW announcer Chris Kloss. Till then, take care, everybody.